Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. What was it like to go into hiding in October 1985 when bombs pierced Salt Lake City? We're going to find out with Brent Ashworth. He says that his wife asked him not to meet with Mark Hoffman the day after the bombings. That literally saved his life. So it's going to be a fun conversation. You won't want to miss it. We'll also find out that he didn't even know who he was hiding from. So it's going to be a really interesting story. By the way, if you'd like to know more about Brent's story, we're going to cover a lot in our conversation. But one of the things we don't cover is what's in his book called Show and Tell. I'm going to give away a free copy, Brent's going to autograph it, of Show and Tell, and it's going to tell a lot more about his life of collecting. Of course, it will talk about Mark Hoffman, but it's got a lot of color photographs in here of a lot of the documents that he has. It's an amazing book. And of course, a lot of these aren't even related to Mormon history. So, I've got the first Lincoln document, things like that. So I'm going to be giving that away in April. So sign up at gospeltangents.com/Ashworth if you'd like to get a free copy of Show and Tell. And I'll hold a drawing here in April, and you could be the lucky owner of Show and Tell. So it's a fantastic book. Now back to our conversation. Now let me make sure I understand the timeline there. So, okay, so the murders occurred on October 15th, 1985, which was a Tuesday, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Steve Christian was killed first thing in the morning.
And that's when Hoffman called. They hadn't announced the killing of.
So Hoffman called you and told you that.
No, he called me. And I wasn't there, so he talked to my wife.
Okay.
And he asked her where I was, and she said, well, he's on his way to work. And then he said to my wife, well, do you remember Steve Christensen?
Oh, okay.
And that's when she said, oh, the guy that finally bought the salamander letter says, yeah, well, he's been murdered. This is before it was found out that Mrs. Sheets had died or was about to be killed. So she had to be willing to tell that, and she did, and that was passed.
Okay,
along.
So you're fast forwarding a couple of days when you're in St. George, and now the now
yeah,
you're
and then
telling
I went
the
back. I'm sorry, but yeah, this is the day of the actual bombings on the 15th that she was given that call by Mark, and then the next day Mark called my secretary and tried to get a hold of me, and she said, oh, I think he's gone to Salt Lake.
And, now, were you a prosecutor then?
I had left that years before, and by this point I was a general counsel to a dietary supplement company called Nature Sunshine Products.
Oh wow! I used to work at Solar Ray.
I was vice president of them for almost 27 years, a long time.
Hmm.
And it was during that time, and at that time our plant and everything was in Spanish Fork, so I had to drive from Provo, our home down there, every day. And Mark had called my secretary that morning, and she'd mentioned, my day for meeting him and for going to Salt Lake on business with our attorneys of Ancop Bagley up the tower, Key Bank Tower in the mall then, was Wednesday.
This is the Crossroads Mall.
Crossroads Mall.
This is now the, I'm trying to remember the name of it. Yeah. Church has rebuilt it.
Right, yeah, it's the... what is it? The Creek? What is it?
City Creek Mall.
City Creek Mall.
Couldn't remember it either.
And I don't go to malls much anymore. But anyway, it was Crossroads at the time. And Mark would call me up. The regular routine was that I would go by his home in the morning on Maria Avenue. Anytime you want to stop this, I'll show you the Haas Hoffman sign. It's in my closet.
Oh, I'll get a picture of it. We'll add it in.
I've collected a lot of stuff over the years, and that's in there too. It was in the Netflix thing when it was still hanging there on the thing, but I've got it. Any rate, so you'd pass the Haas Hoffman sign and that was his parents' home, but he was living in or buying from at the time. And when I first knew him, he was down in South Salt Lake. But then he moved up into his parents' home, Maria Avenue, later.
So let's talk a little bit about the the day of the bombings.
But I was heading up to Salt Lake because we normally I didn't go on Tuesdays, but we had a what was called an S-8. We had to file with the SEC because we had a product that was goofed up, and we were a 12G reporting company with the SEC, which meant we had to issue a notice to our shareholders that we've got a little problem with one of our products, okay? That's a requirement.
So, like a recall or something?
Yeah, like to see if we had to do a recall, but at least to notice the shareholders. It's called an S-8. And our securities attorney, Brent Christensen, is one of the four men altogether that notified me of the bombing because he's up in the Key Bank Tower at, where I would have been visiting on Wednesdays. And so I visited him on Tuesday because we had this filing. Just happened to be that week. And at any rate, I was on my way up when I had the radio on and heard that that there'd been a bombing,
a second bombing.
The first bombing I heard on the news, too, going to work. And then when I'm back in my car heading to Salt Lake to go up to Vancouver Bagley, Brent Christensen, the attorney up there, a good friend, to see what we needed to do to file, with the SEC. I'm going through American Fork, the old road, at the time, before I hit the freeway. And I hear over the radio that there's been a second bombing. And it's kind of like Turley said on the tape, when there's two bombings the same day, you're thinking, hey, there's a serial bomber, killer out there. So that really made me nervous, but I was heading up there anyway, and of course I wasn't going to meet with Mark that day. That wasn't the right day. We met on Wednesdays. So I met with Brent Christensen, and I met with Steve Woodland, two attorneys who both called me the next day when they identified the third victim as being Mark Hoffman. And they both knew about my involvement with Mark Hoffman and early Mormon documents, so they warned me to get my family and get out of town. At any rate, that was the Sheets bombing on Tuesday, and Wednesday the next day, I'm getting ready to go up, and Mark and I have always had a document deal or something going, and I can't remember what it would have been that day, but I'm sure there was something going on, and getting ready to go, and I get this call from my wife saying, I don't want you going up today. I says, well, look, I'm just going to go up. I may visit with the securities attorneys, but I'm going to visit with Mark. And he says, I don't know, I just have this funny feeling that you shouldn't go up. And I listened to her. Usually half the time I don't, but I did. I listened to her, and we sat home and ate pizza and watched a movie. She saved my life, literally, as I look back on it now. I remember Bud Willoughby, the chief of police, on that first phone call, asked me why I hadn't met with Mark, like I had every other Wednesday afternoon for the previous 4 years. And I had to think a second, oh yeah, well, my wife talked me out of it. I stayed home, we ate pizza and watched a movie. At the end of his call, he said, probably good you listened to your wife. I didn't know about the little time-dated receipt they found in Mark's pocket. And I didn't know about the several eyewitnesses that had seen him pass with a box, in tow. And I learned more about that from George Throckmorton than anybody else, by that time. So it was fascinating. But anyway, that's kind of where we were. And we got four phone calls after they announced it was Mark Hoffman. I remember our daughter came home crying because she thought our good friend Mark Hoffman had been blown up. She didn't know about my run-ins with him or any of that stuff. So we'd never shared that with the kids. And we'd meet in the living room. And usually his wife, Dory, and Mark would take a Easy Boy chair and I'd sit on the couch, facing them. They had a bookshelf over to the east wall, when I go in people's homes, I don't look in their medicine cabinets, but if their books are out, I like checking those out. So that got me in trouble a couple of times with Mark, but that's another story. At any rate, the point was is that...
He didn't want you looking at his books?
Well, yeah, because one day I found a book that wasn't there before, and that may sound strange to you, but I knew what books he had. I've been going there for years, and he had a white leather book that was a history of the Samoan mission, had the Samoan mission presidents in there, and I asked him what that book was when he came into the house. He says, I didn't know you looked at my books. I said, yeah, I look at everybody's books when I'm waiting around for them, which is what I had to do with him a lot of times. His wife was always very nice, but you'd have to wait for Mark sometime. And He says, yeah, it was a book on Samoan mission presidents, and my grandfather was in there. I says, really? I said, I just donated a couple hundred letters of one of the presidents of the Samoan mission to the church in the early 20th century. He got really quiet, and then he said, well, who was that? And it turned out William Gailey Sears was his grandfather, and those are the letters I donated to the church. And he was really angry with me. I've only seen him angry about four times, but that was at me, and that was one of the times he was really angry. And I tried to calm him down a little. I said, well, I'm sure the church would let you look at them or whatever if you need to, you know, want to get some copies and things. I mean, I just tried to get myself out of there that time.
He had probably stolen it from the church, you think?
Oh, no. No, it was legit. I'd gotten it from a source. It had nothing to do with Mark. But I donated them to the church, and he was upset to hear that I had donated letters of his grandfather. Turned out later, and in a talk with his mother briefly at his home one day on his birthday, when incidentally, Hoffman's birthday was December 7th, which is
Pearl Harbor Day.
Yeah, which is a day that we'll live in collecting infamy, too.
Now, was it 1941? Was it the same year?
No, he was born in 54. He was a young kid. He was 5 years younger than me, but he was born in 54. So I think the same year Christensen was born. I was older than them. But at any rate, I don't want to go too far. This gets really complicated, but the point of the matter is that she made it known to me on his birthday one day when she was bringing a suit by. It's the only time I ever met her for Mark for his birthday, that the family was still pretty upset over her father being excommunicated as a mission president. And among the papers I later got that came from Grunder's collection, I bought all of what Al Rust had left. I bought Shannon's stuff. I bought stuff from Kurt Bench. Nobody wanted to have any Hoffman stuff, so I ended up with all the Hoffman stuff. Consequently, the church wanted my Hoffman collection a few years ago, and I gave them 15 full bins like this full of Hoffman stuff.
Oh, my goodness.
I kept a bin for myself or two, and I've got one of those here, but they're mostly things that I was involved with. But at any rate, it was during that time that she made the statement about her father being excommunicated. And so when Hoffman found that I was looking at the book and had donated, his letters, which I didn't know that was his grandpa, but they were, he was quite upset with me. And I just tried to get myself out of there that day. That wasn't the usual. Typically, I'd go up to his house. He would bait me with something. Oh, I've just found this or, you know, whatever, and it could be yours, you know. And we'll meet at our spot. You know, well, we always met right after lunch, about 2:15, because I met with the attorneys during lunchtime, and that way I could get a cheaper price out of them, you know, for their time. Van Cupp Bagley was we were a public company, 12G reporting company with the SEC, and they did our stock work. And so we were selling our stocks and so on. So we had to report everything that was a little unusual or whatever to the SEC. And anyway, so I would meet with him down there at our spot, and he'd just call me up and say, if I didn't make it to the house, he said, I have something for you, and we'll meet at our spot. And I said, okay, fine. And he always knew it was around 2:15 because that's when I got done at the tower and would come down, the elevator there. And we always met at Walden Bookstore because it was just around the corner from the elevators. And we could be looking at a book or something, waiting for the other one to get there, you know, which we love books, so that's an easy place to go. Well, the day of the bombing, Hoffman had been there. I didn't go up that day, but I guess he thought I'd be up there that day.
So this is Wednesday?
Wednesday the 15th. This is the 16th, I'm sorry, the day after the bombings. It was the 16th, and he'd called my secretary that morning, see if I was coming. She thought, as far as I know, he's coming up. I didn't go up because my wife talked me out of it. And just said, I don't feel good about it.
You had gone home before you were heading up? Is that?
Yeah,
is that
I went happened? Home because she talked me out of going up. She said, I feel funny about it. She says, I'm just going up to visit with our attorneys and then with Mark. And she says, well, I just feel funny about it. I says, why is that? Well, two people were just murdered with bombs yesterday, and I just somehow feel like he shouldn't go up. That's what she said. And so we sat home and ate pizza and watched a movie. You know, so some of the books have me missing a bomb by 10 minutes, but I wasn't even up there for our appointment. But one thing, but Hoffman was, and he was there, and he I guess got bored after a few minutes, and he bought a 50-cent Wall Street Journal. Well, time dating was just coming in 1985, and he got a time dated receipt, which they found in his pockets was dated less than 8 minutes from the time he bought that Wall Street Journal and walked up the street and got himself blown up in his car. So he was put right at the spot we met, at the time we met, with that time dated receipt. And I was shown that before I went on the witness stand at the preliminary hearing. So, you know,
so that bomb
that
was
kind of removed
for you, right?
All questions out of my mind as to who he was after. Plus, years ago, for the 30th anniversary of the Hoffman thing, BYU Collectors Book Collectors Conference asked me and George Throckmorton to put on a little thing about Hoffman, you know. And you do it for three different groups, so it would be like 45 minutes to an hour apiece. And I went on first because George told the story about how they solved the thing later. And I went on. They always have me up first. I'm the dumb guy, you know. And they tell me about, I tell them about what I remember from Mark and what, you know, how he hooked me on hook, line, and sinker on every little thing he wanted me to have. And I think I really was one of his biggest customers because I bought a lot more stuff than anybody else I knew, except for maybe the church. But at any rate, somebody asked me about the third bombing at, you know, right off, and I says, well, I don't, like I did on the Netflix, I don't know if it was for me, but I haven't been able to eliminate myself as a possible target. Then George gets up and he says, oh yeah, he was trying to kill you. And he go into some other things that the police knew. And I says, well, Kenny Farnsworth, who was the detective assigned to me, never told me that, George. And he says, well, that's because Kenny Farnsworth, rest his soul, he's passed away now. He's a very fine detective. But he said, we didn't tell him about all of that because he was dealing with you, you know. And we found that Kenny was telling a lot of stuff to the Tribune and the newspapers. So we just blocked the leak by not telling him about that. So I got that from George later. And so that kind of nailed it. And, of course, they had shown me that time-dated receipt during the preliminary hearing back then.
Well, and you also told me that they found a package, and what was the name on the package?
Well, Brent, the thing was burning, you know. Mark put names on all the packages. That's why they knew the first one, the name survived, Steve Christensen. The name part of the brown wrapping paper survived in black ink. And Gary Sheets' name, I've seen both of them. What was left from that package had Gary Sheets' name. Obviously, it was left for him, but...
And his wife picked it up.
His wife picked it up. Yeah, it could have been a child. It could have been a paper boy. It could have been anybody. That's how cold-hearted he was. That bomb didn't even need to be activated. You know, it just had to look as similar. But it shows, and especially they showed that Netflix by Mark's own words, how cold-hearted he was on that bombing. And the one with Steve, of course, was even wrapped with cement nails, so he wanted to make sure he killed him, which he did. Kenny Farnsworth showed me years ago the death scene pictures, and I tried not to pass that around, but they were pretty horrible, you know.
Yeah, I heard the directors kind of didn't show the worst ones.
Yeah, they didn't. And the one that bugged me the most wasn't Steve, although Steve was kind of a blob there because of what it had done to him. Mrs. Sheets was staring up in the sky like this with her insides hanging out, and I couldn't get that view of her face out of my mind. And I'd been a prosecutor. I'd been on a lot of those things. But I thought, what a terrible crime. What a terrible thing.
Was this some of the worst crime scenes you'd ever seen as a prosecutor?
Well, yeah. I mean, we saw some pretty bad ones, you know. Where people shoot each other or some other thing, but nothing quite like this. In fact, I thought they had the wrong guy for about 3 weeks. And Bud Willoughby had asked me to come up and help the police. But I thought they had the wrong guy for the first few weeks I was helping the police. Bud Willoughby, rather than going up and visiting with our attorneys and visiting with Mark, I was going up every Wednesday afterwards helping them with their case. And they let me. I was the only victim I ever saw go through. I got to go through all of the crime stuff from the case, and never saw anybody else. They showed me a room of Steve Christensen's materials, but they kept me out of it because I didn't know Steve Christensen. I had one phone call with him.
Is this because you have your previous history as a prosecutor? They felt like they could trust you. Is that why?
I think that was part of it. Plus, they knew I was a victim in the case too. And I think the combination of the two, you know, was probably the reason they let me in on it. But it was about 3 weeks into it when I'd found the Betsy Ross letter. Oh, here's your Betsy Ross letter. I found several of the things going through Mark's stuff, which I helped him with. And but then one day, I was still thinking, you got the wrong guy here. And yeah, Mark's a liar and a cheat, but he, you know, he'd never murder anybody. He didn't have the guts for that. He was a wimp. I couldn't see, you know, in the police report, they called him Mr. Milquetoast. I mean, that's the way he came across with everybody, especially back east when he went back east. There's this hayseed from Utah, you know. So I just couldn't figure that in my mind. I'd been involved with a lot of crime things down in Price, and just I couldn't figure he would be, you know, the one to kill people. And at any rate, Kenny Farnsworth one day brought in this box of burn stuff from his car. He just left it in front of me and left the room. He said, I just want you to look through this. And I started looking at it, and even though they were burned, they were the remnants of catalogs that I'd gotten, too, from book dealers, from autograph dealers, from you know, various collectors, stamp dealers, coin dealers, things like that throughout the country. I got almost identical ones. The only difference was when I get my catalog, I immediately open it up and mark it up. None of these had ever been opened. I mean, they still had the covers on them, or they had the staples in them. Even though they were burned, I could tell they'd never been open. And I looked at him for about 10 minutes, and Kenny came back in the room, and I says, you're right. He's probably guilty of murder. And he says, man, what happened to you? And I says, well, he wasn't what I thought he was. Any dealer or collector, the first thing we do is open our catalogs. That's the most exciting thing you get as a dealer or collector is your catalogs. He didn't open any of these. They're burned, but I can tell none of them were ever open. They still got the staples in them, or they've still got the part of the wrapping paper on them, the covers, the envelopes, whatever they came in. I have mostly the same catalogs, but mine are all marked up. He's never marked these, so. He wasn't what I thought he was.
Because you would have expected him to be, like, combing through, looking through
good
stuff.
Oh, yeah. You know, none of these things have been opened.
Why do you think he didn't open them? He didn't care?
Well, he didn't need to open them. He was doing his own stuff. Why would he need to open them, you know?
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Brent Ashworth. In our next conversation, we'll talk about how church leaders allowed Mark Hoffman into church archives.
In fact, I remember Hoffman taking me into the vault of the church historian, Homer Durham. He had complete permission to do what he wanted to in there. It was crazy. But Hoffman had the keys to the kingdom. They didn't talk much about that on Netflix, but the fact is that he took me in there one day and we saw stuff I've never seen since or heard of since, you know?
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and for $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruptions. If you'd like to see the whole video, that's just $8 a month, and you can sign up either at youtube.com/gospeltangents or on our website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button, or you can go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and I'll just need to make sure that we're Facebook friends, and I'll add you to our insiders group, and you can see the entire interview uncut. If you'd like to get PDF transcripts of our interviews, those are just $10 a month. And for just $15 a month, I will send you paperback versions of our transcripts as soon as they come out. Or, of course, you can buy them on Amazon as well. Go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all of our transcripts there. Don't forget to sign up for our updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Of course, you can follow us at Gospel Tangents on Twitter. To hear our interviews updated to your podcast player, go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. and make sure you give us a 5-star review. And of course, you should show your support for Gospel Tangents with one of these cool t-shirts, like this green one, or light blue, sport gray, royal blue, purple, of course black, beautiful gold, and of course Utah red. I probably left out some colors, but if you want to see more, go to gospeltangents.com/shop and you can get one of these. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.